Good morning, everyone. It's so good to see each of you here in the house of the Lord. We're continuing in our series of messages, The Great Rescue. It's kind of an overview of the whole Bible, and I do believe that's the theme of the whole Bible, that the point of the Bible is that God, through it, is trying to find us and rescue us. But before we dive into today's message, I want us to stand together and let's repeat our theme verse for the year. If you would stand and recite it along with me. You ready? Let's go. You are good and you do good. Teach me your statutes. Psalm 119:68. Thank you so much. You may be seated. Major story that comes before their passage we're looking at today is the story of Noah and the flood. And in that story, human evil has become so horrendous that God looks down and says, I am sorry I ever created humans. I'm going to wipe them off the face of the earth along with everything they have tainted. But we're told that Noah found favor in God's eyes, and because of that, God chose a different route. He did bring the flood, but he did not eradicate life. He preserved it in an ark, both human and animal life, so that after the flood they could repopulate the earth. But if we continue reading the story of Noah, we realize immediately that the problem has not gone away. There is still evil in human interactions with one another. And we might wonder, does that mean that that's it? That's what we're stuck with forever. God commits himself to Noah and to the whole earth after the flood and says, I will never again destroy life on earth through flood waters. And he even puts the rainbow in the sky and makes of the rainbow a symbol of his covenant to not again destroy, but to sustain life. Does this mean then that that's it? The world's going to be messed up forever, that wickedness and sin and evil are going to be realities that we never get rid of? And does that mean that God's just going to step back and keep things running, but let it get the way it was before the flood? Let evil continue unimpeded, unhindered, uncontrolled? I've titled today's message, Babel and God's Middle Way. We're in Genesis chapter 11. We'll look at the first 9 verses. Let's dive right in. The whole earth had one language and one set of words. And as they journeyed from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let's make bricks and fire them so they are hardened. And brick became their stone and tar became their mortar. Then they said, come, let's build ourselves a city and a tower with its peak in the heavens, and let's make a name for ourselves, lest we scatter over the face of the whole earth. We are told by Moses that initially the human race shared one language, one set of words. That sounds so idyllic to us today. Even when we speak the same language, we don't share the same set of words today. You can speak to a Brit about a cookie, and they'll not know what you're talking about, or they'll have something very different in mind. And he will talk to you about a biscuit, and you'll think of something very different than what he's talking about. Because even in the same language, we don't have the same set of words. But initially, there was one language, one way to call things. Everybody could communicate very easily. That sounds idyllic. And it was. It was great to be able to communicate with that ease. And after they've gotten off the ark and begin to populate the earth, they travel to the east and find in the land of Shinar a plain. And that land of Shinar is what later would come to be known as Babylonia. So we're talking about the Fertile Crescent between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, that plain area there that is well watered by those two rivers. Great place to set up and to establish themselves. So they stop there and stay. And then as they are conversing with one another, they say, you know what, let's let's take the mud that there is here and let's fire it. And they realized, they discovered that if they took mud and didn't just bake it in the sun, but actually put it into a kiln, they could get that brick to turn hard as stone. And it would be comparable to stone as a building material. Now, in the history of Israel, the land of Canaan has a lot of rock. If you've ever been to Israel, you realize that they have a lot of ancient constructions, and they're built with stone. But in the area of the Tigris and Euphrates, they didn't have a whole lot of stone out there. What they had was a lot of mud. But they realized if you fire this hot enough, you can get this stuff comparable to stone in terms of a building material. And they didn't have mortar, they had tar, but between hardened bricks and tar, they could build great constructions. And they've figured out this technology and they want to put it to use. So this is the project they come up with. Let's build ourselves a city. Let's build a tower. And it's described kind of like a mountain with its peak in the heavens. Let's build our way up to the heavens themselves. Let's make a name for ourselves, lest we scatter over the face of the whole earth. So this project is about building something greater than anyone could do on his own. This project requires all hands on deck and everybody pooling resources and intelligence and ingenuity and muscle and putting everything together to construct this enormous tower to reach into the heavens themselves. And this is an attempt to introduce ourselves as humans into the realm of what right now is beyond our grasp. We've continued with that kind of effort, right? Why did we ever think it was important to make our way into space? To make our way to the moon? We've always wanted to insert ourselves into the spaces we currently find beyond our grasp. We want to aspire to more. And they wanted to place themselves in the heavens themselves, make a name for themselves. And they're not wrong. When people have put a lot of effort together and constructed something really impressive, people remember who did that. You may not know much about the history of the Egyptians, but if I were to ask anybody here who built the Great Pyramid of Giza, you would all say immediately, the Egyptians did it. We know that. If I were to ask you who built the Eiffel Tower, you wouldn't say, was it the Chinese? No, you know it's the French. When you do something great, people recognize you for it and remember. And you might not know anything else about them, but you know that that was their accomplishment. That's kind of the thought here. Let's make a name for ourselves. Let's do something tremendous and great. And there's a concern, lest we scatter over the face of the whole earth. And there's a recognition in the early days of the human race that together we can accomplish a lot more than if we're scattered. If we dilute our presence and separate out into smaller groups, we can accomplish a lot less. But if we're all together, then all of us together can do great things. So let's not scatter over the face of the whole earth. Let's build a project together. What we have here is basically the first humanist project. And we might wonder, as we keep reading, God clearly does not approve of this project, and we might wonder about that. Isn't unity a good thing? Why would God have a problem with it? And I can think of a few reasons. First off, in Genesis chapter 9, after the flood, this is what God has to say to Noah and his sons. Chapter 9, verse 1, and also verse 7. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And you, be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. So whereas God has instructed them to spread out and fill the earth, they have instead said, let's make sure we don't do that. Let's make sure we don't scatter across the face of the earth, but let's all stay together. Let's all build this great thing together. So already, this project begins in direct defiance of God's instructions, which tells us that this isn't a project of, let's see how well we can bear the image and likeness of God in this world. This was a project to say, let's do something apart from God. Let's see how high we can reach on our own. Let's see what a great thing we can do all by ourselves. Now, as we study archaeology and look at all these things and the types of constructions you would find in that part of the world, this description of a great tower reaching to the heavens most closely resembles a ziggurat, which was, after this period, becomes the kind of great things that people will build. And this is the way they did in that part of the world later on. They would build these great ziggurats, and these constructions were not meant to be lived in. They were solid through and through. There was nothing to go inside. It was just dirt and rock. But it was basically a huge stairway, a square stairway with each subsequent section being smaller than the one beneath it, and a stepway that humans could use to get to the top. But the whole purpose of this whole construction of the ziggurat was not for people to live in. Only the priest would ascend to the top every day to change out the food, because at the top of the ziggurat, they would put a bed, and daily they would put out food. And they would actually build the temple to the god at the base of the ziggurat. And the hope was, we're trying to facilitate things for the god. So as he's doing his business up in the heavens, he might want to come visit us if we make a nice place for him to stop and rest and get some food. And then maybe we'll get some blessing from the gods, and they would have the temple at the base of the ziggurat. Now, that eventually is the way these construction projects worked. But notice that the description Moses gives us of this first project is not that. This isn't an attempt to draw near to God or to any other god, any pagan god. This is a purely human attempt about raising the name of humankind. It's not any kind of an act of devotion to anything except devotion to ourselves. And this is the very first humanist project. And what's a humanist project? Well, it's the idea of, what all can we accomplish and without God? Let's take God out of the picture and let's just say, what can humans do all on their own? And we have faced many versions of this through human history. This is the first expression of a humanist project. And what does God say about it? Verse 5. But Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower that the children of man had built. And Yahweh said, look, the people are one. They all share one language, and this they have begun to do. Now nothing will be impossible to them of all that they plan to do. Come, let us go down and mix up their language there so that they will not understand one another's language. So, I think Moses is very clear to us that even though they had built this grand structure to the heavens, Yahweh still had to come down to even look at it. So clearly they have not attained to godhood by any stretch of the imagination. God has to reduce himself from his position to even come down to look at what they've built. And notice how Moses here, where in other passages in Genesis, he has described humans as sons of God, those created by God in his image and likeness. Now he very pointedly describes this city and this tower as a project of the children of man, making it very clear that this is simply a human accomplishment, and God was not consulted or obeyed in any part of the process. This was a human thing accomplished by the children of man. God looks down and looks upon it, and again, God uses here the plural. And I've talked about this before. There are several instances in Genesis where God speaks in the plural, and I do not believe that he is addressing a heavenly council. My main reason for that is that in none of these passages is anybody else mentioned. God is talking in the plural, but there's no identification of anybody else in any kind of an audience. So I believe that when God is using the plural in these passages in Genesis, he is simply using it to convey his own greatness and his majesty. And what we are looking at here is kind of an internal dialogue within God himself as he is contemplating what he is going to do. So what is God thinking through here? He says, look, the people are one. They share one language. And I read that and I think, isn't that great? Wouldn't that be wonderful? If we were all united as human beings on this earth, if there were no war, if we were not fighting one another, if we were perfectly united and could easily understand each other and didn't have the barrier that we have today of language, but could just with the ease of breathing communicate with anybody, wouldn't that be wonderful? Well, obviously, unity is something God prizes. If we read the Bible, that becomes very clear. And a shared life and perspective, that's at the very heart of what God calls his people to do. The problem isn't the unity. The problem is, and this they have begun to do. It's not the unity itself. It's what is this unity trying to accomplish? I can describe in relatively recent human history an example of where there was great unity of purpose and intellect and effort and strength, Nazi Germany. Boy, that was a united nation. They had a vision for what humankind should look like, and they thought it was going to be glorious, and it was going to be far better than any expression of humanity we had ever known in the history of the world, and they would implement this across the world. And as a nation, they had one heart and mind and soul in pursuit of that goal. But it was a wicked vision. So just unity is not in and of itself good or bad. It just depends on what you're united around. What is it that you're pursuing? And this is the problem. This they have begun to do. They have decided, let's get God out of the picture. Let's ignore his instructions and let's see what we can do on our own. And let's aspire to the heavens themselves on our own. It's basically what Eve wanted in the garden. I will eat this and I will become God. It's a continuation of the same thing, but now, all together, let's do this together. And God says, now nothing will be impossible to them of all that they plan to do. And I don't believe that God here is suggesting that if we did put all of our heads together, we could eventually aspire to godhood. I don't think that's what he's saying. What I think he is saying is that the plans people are making together now, because of the way I have designed creation and I have created humans specifically in my image and likeness with the purpose of ruling and subduing the rest of creation, there is nothing left in creation to stand against them. There is nothing that will stop them from doing whatever it is they want to do. And that is true. To this day, humans have been able to impose their will on creation any way they want to. I think that's what God's saying, that nothing will be impossible to them of all they're planning to do. And God can see the end from the beginning. God knows exactly where this project is headed. And God says, that's not going to work. I want you to think for a moment. Put yourself in God's shoes. Let's play a little thought experiment. Pretend you're God and you look down on the human race and they have begun the first humanist project and this is the human race is all together in this one language, one mind, and they are trying to construct the first godless human empire. And it's not one of many, it is the only human empire on earth. And you know that's going to be an evil thing. How do you break that up? Do you start a war? Do you get people to kill each other? How do you break that up if you're God without violence, without hatred? I think we find in the story of Babel the tremendous depth of God's wisdom. He knew he had to fragment the human race, but he didn't want to do it through violence and hatred. How did he accomplish it? Let's go down and mix up their language so that they will not understand one another's language. And God, in his great wisdom, came down and said, okay, now we have many languages. And naturally, this is the way to this day, this is the way we do things, right? You naturally gravitate to people who hear, who when you talk, actually understand what you're saying. You know, we don't naturally gravitate to people who, when we talk, don't understand a word we're saying. That's the challenge of what we're doing as a church, right? But suddenly, people started separating from one another and gathering in smaller groups based on language. And it wasn't violent. It wasn't through war. There was simply a commonality and a difference introduced into the human race. And because of this, they began to spread across the earth. Now, God had already told them they needed to do this because God knew we needed to spread out across the earth and dilute our own ability to accomplish evil things. Because if we all stayed concentrated in one place, it would be just like in the days of Noah. That would just be evil upon evil. But if we spread it out, if we separate out, so humans didn't do it willingly, God had to do it for them, and he used language to accomplish it. Verse 8, so Yahweh scattered them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why its name was called Babel, because there Yahweh mixed up the language of the entire earth, and from there Yahweh scattered them over the face of all the earth. Moses tells us that the name of this place was Babel, or Babel in the Hebrew, because that is the place where languages were mixed up, and it's similar to the Hebrew verb to confuse, which is balal. And that's the way God accomplished the scattering of people across the earth. So I was asking, after Noah, God promises, I'm going to sustain the continued existence of humans, even though evil is still a problem, even though they are still sinful and do evil things, and even though the powerful still oppress the weak, and there's all this horrible stuff, I am going to continue sustaining life. But Babel is the next piece in the story. If our question is God just going to sit back and watch us destroy everything? The answer is absolutely not. Because if with Noah God demonstrates his commitment to sustain our continued existence despite our evil, in Babel he also communicates that he is not going to just sit and watch. He's going to step in and get involved. And this is the perspective from Genesis to Revelation. Through the whole Bible, we are told that there is one person who manages human history, and it's not us. It's God. God is deeply, intimately involved and a participant in the events of human history. And clearly, he has allowed us to do evil things, and we continue to do wicked things. But have you noticed that because at the very beginning, he split us up into all these different languages, every time some tyrant has arisen and fired up a nation on a project of global conquest, they have failed. Because God built in checks and balances across the whole earth. God built in limits to how evil and wicked things can get. And there are moments like World War II where things seem to hang in the balance. You think God was not involved in the ultimate failure of Nazi Germany? You think it was just us? God intervenes and says, I will allow it up to here, and we're done. You are done. And the Bible consistently says that it is God who raises up and brings down kings and nations and empires. Because God is a participant in human history. We don't write our histories this way. Now, the Bible's histories are written that way. The Bible's histories are an attempt to say, this is what God was doing in Israel. We don't write histories that way. We write histories like God's not even a part of the picture. And we write them as though everything that's happening is simply the things we as humans are doing. That is a false version of what's actually happening in the world. The history of the world is the history of God managing human evil and keeping it within bounds so that it does not destroy creation. And because of that, we have the space to live this human life. And we can pursue evil within the limits he imposes. And we can say, I want nothing to do with God. And we can do that. We can make that choice. But God has intervened to put limits to just how wicked and evil things get, because he is also preserving for us the option to turn to him for rescue. So that there is not just darkness, but there is light. There is not just evil, but there is good. One of the great ironies of the modern world is the rise of atheism. People fault God for all the evidences of evil that they find in the world, and their conclusion is God must not exist, because otherwise he would have gotten rid of all the evil. As it turns out, God is very deeply involved in the world. He is shielding us from utter chaos and self-destruction. You think we haven't destroyed ourselves yet because we're that good? Our evil would soon engulf us all and leave nothing behind if we were left to our own devices. And yet we have the gall, the audacity to pat ourselves on the back for all the advancements, all of the progress toward peaceful living, the defense of the powerless, and the inner enlightenment that we claim today. We don't want to recognize that the places in the world where this has begun to happen first are in nations most deeply affected by the Christian faith, who have been under the impact and the voice of the gospel for centuries. Women's suffrage, the abolition of slavery, this did not come out of Islam. It did not come out of Buddhism. It did not come out of Hinduism. Where did it start to happen first in the world? In nations that for centuries had been exposed to the gospel. But we don't think God has anything to do with our advancements. We pat ourselves on the back for that. It's only the bad stuff we want to blame God for, even though the bad stuff is what we're doing. We're the ones doing it. But it's God's fault somehow. God is deeply involved and has preserved, consider the difficulty of what God's facing here. He has preserved our right to choose so that we can choose evil if we want it. But he has had to balance it in such a way that to choose rescue and goodness is still an option. How much evil does he allow? Where does he cut it off? God in his omnipotence and omniscience makes the perfect choice every step of the way. We're in an election year, and I encourage you to be informed and go to the voting booth and vote with an informed conscience. But don't think for a minute that we are driving this nation. God is in control regardless of who wins the election. And God is governing this creation. And if there is evil, he will put a limit to how far he lets it go. because of God's direct involvement, we retain a choice. We can pursue evil as much as we want within the limits he imposes, or we can respond to his invitation to turn back to him, to renounce that path and be rescued from sin. And the question we have to answer is, are we going to turn to God to be rescued? We're going to sing a song of invitation. I'd like to ask you to stand. And I say this a lot. The Word of God is not simply information for you. It's not stories to entertain you. It's not information about how to live a good life. The Bible is a conversation, and in the Bible, God is speaking to you, and he is calling you to respond to him in faith. That's why in every service, we have a time where we can respond to whatever God's been saying to us in his Word. So God is calling you to be rescued. What is your response? If you want to be rescued, I want you to come as we're singing this song. Take the hand of one of the people that are here at the front. Share with them, this is what I'm trying to come and the commitment I want to make to God. And let them pray with you and encourage you. Come while we sing.